today's podcast is about pain. Our pain, the pain of others. This feels like an absolutely vital topic to be exploring at this point. You simply can't dress up or deny that we're living in a truly painful moment, coming out of a global pandemic and into a worldwide war zone. At least, that's how it feels. My Twitter feed these days is a bizarre blend of geopolitics and videos of riot police, and then next to that, all manner of crypto art, and too often, it seems like these things are existing separately from one another, which isn't a problem in its own right, but it actually is a problem because I know that it's not true. We are hurting, the world is hurting, and this is ultimately an art movement, one that's too online to be unaware of every little nuance of all the suffering in the world today. Abstract expressionism, surrealism, postmodernism, we can look at so many of the influential artistic epochs over the last 100 years and find them also rooted in pain and how artists were dealing with it. Our guest today is the artist Awful Eye, who, as you will hear in this podcast, is not only a man who lives every day with pain, but who actively confronts that pain, internalizes it, and expresses it in his art. Our conversation will take us from Awful Eye's history designing concert posters, to a diagnosis that would change his life and his art, to a series of truly tough questions about meeting pain in the world with sensitivity and honesty. In putting this podcast together, I was perhaps naive in how emotional it would get, how challenging these questions would be to answer, and also how truly thoughtful a mind and a talent Awful Eye is. So welcome to a Mocha Live podcast that's all about pain. We do somehow manage to have a little bit of fun this week as well. Anyways, it's all ahead on this episode of the Mocha Live podcast. Thanks so much for being with us. Good evening, everybody. It is 3:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here in lovely Marlborough, New Jersey. We have evolved from showing up late to showing up on time to showing up early on the Mocha Live podcast. Look at us. No technical difficulties this week. We're going to jump right into it. Welcome, everyone, to the Mocha Live podcast. My name is Max Cohen. I will be one of your hosts today. Joining me as my co-host, as he does every week, our friend and compadre, that's the founder of the Museum of Crypto Art, Mr. Colborne Bell. Colborne, how are we finding you today?
Two thumbs up. A little stressed, a little anxious, but glad to be here.
Oh, don't worry, brother. It's just a podcast. always nice to see you with a completely bonkers background. So happy to have you. And then joining us as our guest today on the Mocha Live podcast is a remarkable 3D artist, the creator of Fault Lines, which is a project I want to discuss in detail in a short while. He's got 20 years of experience doing design work, creating concert posters. Just a really fascinating individual. I'm really excited to have him on. And that would be Awful Eye. So please give a warm welcome to Awful Eye. Welcome to the show. How are we doing, Awful Eye?
Doing great. Doing great. Happy to be here.
If I were going to refer to you in one word, would it be awful or would it be I?
Everybody calls me awful. And I kind of love that.
Okay.
That is funny.
We prefer to use diminutive nicknames here on the Mocha Live podcast. So anyways, we have a lot to get to today, so let's just jump right in. And where I kind of want to start our conversation today is with your story, Awful, because there are elements of your story and your artistry as well, obviously, which communicate to me like a sensitivity, an uncommon sensitivity and awareness of how to like incorporate one's own, for lack of a better word, like pain in their artistry. And I want to be very careful because I don't want this to feel exploitative at all, only celebratory, because I think that your story is really triumphant and really celebratory. And you're quite open with it, which is the fact that you're legally blind from a condition, and please correct my pronunciation, but I believe it's Axenfeld-Rieger syndrome. Did I get that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, that's correct.
So, I mean, the first thing that I want to know, Awful, is that like, this is a space like crypto art, crypto NFTs in general that really quite often prioritizes and rewards like anonymity and almost a kind of de-individuation. And you've leaned completely the opposite way, right? Being extremely vulnerable and extremely real. And I'm curious, like, Was that a decision you made when you first kind of came into crypto art, or was it something that you came to over time?
Well, I thought about being anonymous, but I was going by Awful Eye prior to even figuring out what crypto art was. And I was like, there's people that already know me in person as Awful Eye. So, I mean, it would kind of be pointless to have, like, when the real world gets involved, for them to be like, oh, that's Charlie, you know? Like, I mean, so I was like, that's not gonna work, but I don't want to change my name because I've been going by it for so long. And I mean, I got a reputation in the music industry. People know me as Awful Eye. So I mean, I really wasn't worried about being anonymous. And also, I couldn't really tell my story and people believe it without being real and being me and letting people in. And I don't know. It really wasn't like something that I was worried about being like anonymous. I know it helps with art, but also when you're trying to be open about something, because one thing that I never really done in music, I would never tell people that I was legally blind before I worked with them, because mm-hmm. it would cost me clients, you know, like people would find out, hey, this guy can't see good. How's he going to be able to create our art? Which I understand completely. But so I really never leaned into it or told many people until afterwards. And that was when I told them, that was always in person. So that way they could see me and see my eyes, and I could show them like, hey, this eye's completely gone. This one has a hole in it. And like, there's no denying it when you're in person, you know? So I really wanted to lean into that and show people like, hey, it's okay. It's not the end of the world. Like, and yeah, I'm going to start rambling. Does that answer the question? I'm
sorry. Yeah, totally. And I should note, this is like a ramble supportive podcast. Like, we got all the time in the world, but you know, it's something that I think about quite a lot today, especially like I've been just chewing over Xcopy for weeks now. And just the idea that this person who is maybe more unknown than any other like super influential figure in crypto art, whose like face, name, et cetera, aren't really known, that there is just such a surge of financial and like cultural support for this person. So I'm really interested in like this idea of being anonymous and the choice to be anonymous. And then from there, like choosing to return to anonymity. You know, I guess my follow-up question to that is like, how do you juggle this balance of like obviously wanting to be known for your story and fully for who you are, but also, and forgive me if I'm reaching, but you know, what I hear in the story of like not telling people in the music industry that you were blind before they knew you and knew your work, but like not wanting these things to define you and your art and your identity, especially because crypto art likes to reduce people to a couple of like, I mean, a lot of times it's like physical identifiers. Like you think of Koldi with the 3D glasses, you know, you get naturally reduced to kind of like either iconography or like one story beat.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't really think about it much. Maybe it's because I've been creating art for so long. I really just don't even care anymore. it's all about having fun for me. And just the fact that I'm able to still create art, that's enough. It's gotta be at some point. So, I mean, I don't really think you can put artists in like a certain little box either. Cause I mean, like Koldi, for example, he's known for his 3D glasses, but he also creates physical art too. And it's, I mean, there's so much there. And I think that's the big problem. People don't actually dive in and get to know the artists and stuff. And like Koldi, for example, we have such similar backgrounds. Dude grew up in the music industry too. He was a concert photographer. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm gonna put it out there so everybody can go find it. There's a video of him getting pranked on YouTube when he was younger by a band. And like, I'm not going to say his full name, but I found it. And he was like, dude, I thought I didn't know that was on there. But, so, I mean, there's so much that you can do to like dig and figure out who these people are. And like, I'm pretty sure there's some stuff about Xcopy out there that people just haven't looked at because they stay on the surface. And I don't know, that kind of bothers me. I don't like being put in a box.
Yeah, of course. And I think that like, well, before we go on, like I was curious like, as you were speaking, like Colborn, were you ever anonymous when you first got into this, or was it always kind of like,
I was, it was a very conscious decision to like become a public collector.
Can you talk a bit more about like what went into that calculus?
Just that on the collector side, I mean, our understanding was that the space needed to begin to associate, there needed to be like a reputation to real people, and that, you know, we would be emergent as people who could like lead it from a point of like, we're public, we're aiming to do this ethically, and you know, now is the time to begin to like start attaching reputation, identity to a public face and name and figure.
Hmm.
And I think that was like a monumental step forward for the space when people were willing to come forward and say publicly that they were beginning to do this in such a way.
The subtext being that like everyone was mostly anonymous at that time?
Like everybody, unless it was, you know, super rare John or Zach or somebody that was like building in public the thing. All of the larger collectors at that point, Whale Shark, Basileus, Moderats, Token Angels, all pseudo-anonymous private.
Sure. I mean, there is a, I think the right word is bravery in being honest with your identity, right? Because, and it's something that I can sympathize with. When I wrote my first and only novel, I used a pseudonym, one that I came up with in college, which was a gender and a race, because I didn't want people to associate the art itself with identifiers of who I was, that I was male and that I was Jewish and so on and so forth. I didn't want that to color the content. I think that was rather naive, but like, you know, you do run the risk of being, especially like Awful Eye, you have a pretty like unique nuance to your art and your identity. And that runs the risk necessarily of being like tokenized, or no pun intended, being tokenized when you're like honest about that. Like, do you think that transparency has like helped you or hurt you in your experience in crypto art?
Well, I mean, I don't really think it's hurt at all, because when I first got into the space, I didn't even think I was going to make a sale. Hmm. So, I mean, just the fact that people buy my art, that I call that a win. And even with people just appreciating it and sharing it and stuff, that's, yeah, I don't think anything bad has happened because of that. But I do see like the benefit of other people like that have remained anonymous. But yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's hurt. But I don't think it's helped that much either, though.
I mean, let me just add, you know, like there were a lot of people coming into the space, a lot of stories being told, and like Awful Eye for sure made it and like rose out. And I think that was based on storytelling and narrative. And, you know, that is initially, it's a very compelling thing that makes you want to dive in and understand the person more, understand the artwork more, and understand how and why they're creating in this way.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I remember, you know, going like back and forth on Twitter, and you know, there might be 20-30, but like here we are. And you know, that is, I think, testament to the work that you put in and the way you presented yourself. And you know, most people did not persevere or continue to tell, and you did.
Well, I think that also has to do with the fact that I'm not scared to talk to people. Like, I don't care how big you are or anything. If you're a good person, I'll talk to you and I'll try at least. And that's also how I got to know Mocha, about the super rare space. And, but yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I've never been afraid to do is actually talk to people and, reach out and be like, hey, how can we work together? And because that goes back to my time in the music industry, you can't be scared to send emails or contact management and stuff like that. I mean, I've had famous people that were they were the most chill people that I've ever met, and like just as humble. And I mean, it's incredible. So I think that helped out a whole lot. Was I'm not scared to talk. I'll talk your head off.
I want to like super echo that, and I don't really want to blow up anybody's spot here, but I remember, you know, before there was any market around like Grant Yoon or Tejo, they were like in my DMs, like hammering hard. And I just think there is something to be said about the person that is willing to step forward and like represent themselves and their art and really get people on board with what they're building and the stories that they're telling. And it does take a bit of a fearless personality, and it takes a lot of confidence. It takes a lot of self-awareness. So, you know, for everybody out there figuring out like, how do you break in? Well, you have to do it in, you know, you have to do it from yourself.
Yeah. The way I look at that is like, nobody's going to do it for you. Nobody's going to speak for you. Nobody's going to promote your art the way that you do. And I mean, but that's just in life. Like, nobody can do for you what you can do for yourself. So,
but there's a distance I think that you need to have in another sense too, because, you know, I think about just from my own experience, like all the short stories that, for instance, I've submitted to the New Yorker over the years, right? Dozens of stories that never went anywhere. I get rejection. I still sometimes get rejection letters from like things I submitted like years ago. From, I don't know how that's possible, but like you. And I'll fly, like this echoes a sentiment that you had mentioned before of like, I never expected to make a sale. The fact that I even made a sale is like a miracle in and of itself. Like, and that's so emboldening. And like, I think when you identify too much into crypto art, and I can even feel it myself, especially when we used to like put things out on like Medium, and, you know, sometimes I'd spend months writing an essay and it would get tons of traction and people would be telling me that they really enjoyed it and such and such. And then other times, you know, you would be, it would just be crickets. And you have to like, there's no way to do this, but like, you have to like have the distance from the thing where you can celebrate the successes, but not be dragged down by the losses. Cause like in that story that you're, or the experience you had with Tejo and Grant Yoon Colborn, like you could be throwing, you know, information and your story into DMs and trying to talk to people, but the vast majority of cold calls are unanswered. And you have to not be identifying that with like you, your worth, your art's worth. But like, how do you maintain that balance? Awfully, how have you maintained that balance?
Just not caring.
It's that entirely. It's that you just almost like separate it.
Yeah.
It's not personal. It's not your ego.
Yeah. I mean, because not everybody's going to agree with what you have going on. They're not going to like it. It might not be for them. And like in music, there were a ton of times. There were more times that I got told no than times that actually worked out in my favor. But the times that worked out overshadowed the bad stuff that happened and like all the people that told me that it wasn't possible. And I mean, it's all in your will. Like if you want to do something, put the work in, talk to the right people and do it. I mean, that's all it is. And I mean, I think that applies to crypto art, well, art in general, because I mean, I went from making shirts for my band to working with people like Ace Frehley or Riff Raff or Black Flag. And like, that's not supposed to happen. You know, like, yeah. So, I mean, it's all about just not letting the times that people tell you no, like, stop you. Because everybody's going to tell you no, because this is one thing that I've learned. If they couldn't do it, they'll think you can't do it. Mm-hmm. And so don't believe that. Like, just because somebody else couldn't do it doesn't mean that it's not possible. And I mean, I grew up in a little small crap town, you know, and that was hard. And so, I mean, if I could do it, anybody, and this is also what I say about art. People say that, like, not everybody can be an artist. I'm like, don't say that, because anybody can do it. Anybody that really wants to be an artist can sit down and learn and practice and practice and practice.
But there is something about, yes, I'm sorry, Awful, please.
Oh, no, go ahead.
There's something about, you know, I don't want to make a gross generalization about art in general, but I definitely know within crypto art, we have this tendency, and we can view it from insidious sources if we want to. There's a tendency to say that if you have achieved some kind of monumental success, it's because you're a genius, you know, some kind of like unassailable, on some unassailable elevated plane above everyone else. And then if you've been elevated to that level by collectors or institutions, etc., then you're like, there's a pretty easy way to, you look at all criticism of you and say, oh, it's just jealousy that other people haven't achieved my success, or bitterness and such. And I do feel like that's ossifying to people's like acceptance of the work that gets put in and the journey that you're on, because this is, I guess, the subtext of the whole thing. Like, people who are really successful get tokenized into these like versions of their success, right? Like, XCopy is not a person. It's so far past being a real person and a real artist. It's just an idea and, you know, the few kind of visual identifiers that we associate with this person, and this like totally aggrandized idea of what success looks like. And I do feel like it's difficult in the space that is overtly and tacitly communicating that like all successes are due to a genius that you cannot attain unless you put in some ungodly amount of work that you can never actually do, or have some level of talent which nobody can ever actually have, then you're not worthy. And I think that's where like the distance becomes so difficult, because like the more time I spend on crypto Twitter, the more it like drags me down, right? Like, and then I can see it dragging other people down when you're being caught in the crossfire of these kinds of conversations. I don't have a question off of that per se, but it's just like, it seems like the metrics of art movements in general, which are star systems kind of by economic necessity, make it a lot more difficult to, I don't know, become okay with a lack of success.
Yeah, but that also has to go with like your view of success, because going back to music, I'm sorry.
Please.
Even though I worked with a ton of artists, it didn't pay a whole lot. And like, a lot of people look at what I've done and they're like, oh, you must be so successful. And I'm like, well, it depends. Am I happy? Yeah, absolutely. So in that sense, yeah, I'm successful. I worked with a ton of people that like I could never dream of. And I got to go to shows that like that were sold out. And like, I would skip the line and bring all of my friends with me. And like, we all got open bars and stuff. So, I mean, it just depends on what your view of success is. And if it's all monetary, then I don't know if that's a good thing, because there's more to life than just money. And I know that's weird being in the crypto space, like that's all everybody cares about. But doing something that makes you happy, that is where the real value is, I think. And for that's sure. Why I like art. I've done it most of my life, and yeah, it's a lot of fun. And if I wasn't having fun with it, I don't care how much money it made me, I probably wouldn't do it.
Look, I'm going to just kind of echo that. I came from the pure finance side of crypto into the arts, right? And that was a very conscious decision to move away from these people that were hyper-focused on money. And then, obviously, when the market took over, you just kind of realized that everything is the same. And there is like this roving band of just like hype people that glom on to whatever like momentum inspired economic moment is happening. And they are just byproducts of a much larger, like terrible system. And maybe it is like the crypto that just intensifies it, that makes all of these things more liquid, more fluid, the ability to like pour all of these crazy marketing skills in.
Well, how can it not? I mean, like you just look at the, I mean, obviously like cryptocurrency is the underpinning of all this stuff, and like all crypto news becomes crypto art news. And then on top of it, you have like people who, you know, they say, oh, the super rare ticker went off for me. And it's like, well, what does that signify? It signifies a sale. And the sale is the best way we have, maybe not the best, but certainly the most accepted way we have of communicating to somebody that their art is worthwhile and thus their talent is, you know, approved by the community. And I want to just jump.
It is like very manipulated still, obviously, you know, there's whatever.
Yeah, no, of course.
Yeah.
we'll get bogged down in this topic. I want to just move on to quickly to AI. And the reason I want to bring up AI briefly is because, you know, we've talked obviously a lot about this in the podcast, and that we're on the verge collectively, societally, of being so subsumed with this kind of homogenous AI artistry of a kind that flattens like cultural and live differences. And I have this fear that it's going to end up like flattening our perception of the world, right? And that makes me really interested in A, people's individual stories and people with individual stories. And then you, Awful, like obviously have a very unique perspective. It's almost oxymoronic, right? It's like a blind visual artist, which is like Beethoven writing symphonies despite being deaf, right? And it's like, it's very you. And again, and you embrace it and you communicate it and you've like leverage it for your artistry. I'm curious, like, how do you capture or communicate that in your artistry? Like, is it something that you consciously consider? You know, like I know you put out a piece, Invasion, a couple of days ago, which, you know, you centralize the I literally in a fair amount of your work.
Yeah, that's actually something that I've, in the past like couple of years, I've started doing. And it's the reason behind that is because I'm going through it, and like it hurts more now, so I can't help but focus on eyes. And I mean, because it's actual physical pain. And I know people like talk about like how much they put into their art, but I put physical pain into mine. And like there's times when I have to lay down and like I can't work. Like my eye, it'll start watering real bad and I can't see, so I have to go lay down and take a break. And but yeah, that's just something that I've been I guess focusing on is our eyes. And I do whatever's personal to me, and that's just something that's really, really, really personal right now is pain. And that sounds so bad, but it's the truth. But it does. It sounds bad when I say it like that. But I don't know any other way to say it. Like it's actual physical pain that made me want to put eyes and stuff.
Well, you know, I want to hold on that for a second, right? Because I do think that there's a part of this conversation about pain that I really want to have. And I want to kind of focus it through Fault Lines, a collection of yours. It's 400 pieces, which, as far as I can tell, they kind of like respond in real time to like seismic activity throughout the world. And I was going through the collection, and you know, you can kind of like chart various seismic activities through the piece, right? You can like literally click through them and it changes the aesthetics of the piece. But the subtext to Fault Lines is that your artistry will become most pronounced when something has occurred that has caused a massive amount of pain, right? Larger, like physically larger earthquake means like a greater expression in the aesthetics. And I mean, that means that basically like you're chronicling this information in real time, but you're also chronicling like pain in real time, especially like these kind of far away tragedies, tragedies that might feel kind of far away. And I think that that's obviously really personal. We are in a period of time in the world that is its most conflicted, I believe in like 80 years, I read somewhere. And so like, I mean, did you know that when you were creating Fault Lines that you would be wading into such like a sensitive and painful kind of place?
Yeah and no. If you look at it, when a big earthquake happens, the waveform that's in the middle, that's what that is. It creates the vertical lines and stuff. That will kind of glow the more people that are affected by the earthquake. Mm-hmm. But that was one thing that I was talking to Matt Cain about. Not trying to name drop anybody, but it's the truth.
We talk about Matt Cain on every single episode.
I love that dude.
We love Matt Cain, yeah.
But we was talking about it, and that's one thing that he said was like, what about when people's lives are affected by what you're picking up? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. But that's why I made it kind of glow to like, kind of like a candlelight, you know, like show respect. And that was my thinking. But there was a recent earthquake. I'd have to go back and look where it was. But I wish I knew. But there was a large one
in Taiwan.
Yeah, that was it. That kind of messed with me, and like I almost burned the rest of the collection. Mm. Like if it wasn't for Cody, I would have burned all of them that I could, because that hurt so bad to know that I was picking up people's lives that were possibly being lost. And like, then I would go on Twitter and search Taiwan and see buildings falling, like apartments. And I'm like, dude, this isn't right. This isn't what art's supposed to be like. I'm not supposed to sit here months later and almost cry about this stuff, you know? Like, and so I am about to cry thinking about that. Like that was something that I wasn't expecting. And that hurt. Like that hurt me bad to the point to where I was like, I've got to get rid of these. I got to burn them. And like, it hurt.
If you don't mind my asking, what was the advice that Coldy gave you about the piece? She said that.
Just think about it. Take some time and think about it. He was like, that yes, it's showing some bad stuff, but it's also, I can't remember how he actually worded it. I can't remember exactly. I don't want to say it wrong, but it was real nice.
Sure. It's something I'm thinking about kind of constantly, right? Like, is it our right? Is it our duty to create art out of like the pain that we are seeing in the world? And like, what kinds of considerations do we need to make if we are going to tackle topics, however creatively we choose to do so, that reflect like the global strife that we can't avoid seeing and internalizing and being affected by? That's a big question.
Yeah, I don't know. It was hard. It's still hard. But
I think it's a necessity.
Yeah. But also you really need to think about what you're doing if you're doing something like what I've done with Fault Lines or anything like that, where people's lives are going to be affected in a bad way, because people lost everything. And like, I couldn't even promote the artwork then. Like that was bad. And I'm like, how do I even attempt to be like, hey, you could buy this artwork right here and it'll show you all these earthquakes that are happening. Like that's not nice. That's not a good person. And so while all that was going on, I couldn't even really talk about the art. It was mainly just like, oh crap, these people are dying. That should be the focus. It's not about me. It's not about the artwork. These people are dying. That's it.
It reminds me a lot of, like modernist art during like World War I and World War II. And you have, I'll just go from like the literary side, right? You have, you're like F. Scott Fitzgerald or Hemingway, right? Who are writing these works that are disconnected from like pain that's happening. And it's all very kind of like these personal stories of malaise and how like the world's pain affected them. You know, like, I don't think Fitzgerald fought in the war, but like, Hemingway was definitely like an ambulance driver during World War II. I believe he fought in the Italian Civil War, and like the stories come through, but it's a different kind of pain, right? It's more capturing, it's capturing essentially what we're talking about, right? Like being on the outside of this for the most part, picking up on the vibrations, again, no pun intended, to fault lines. Whereas someone like Elie Wiesel, who's writing like Night from his experience in the Holocaust, it's an entirely different, it's almost like they are not even connected art forms. But they're both, I think, vital because there are different stories, right? The story of like living in a world that is very subsumed with its own pain is equally as valid as the pain itself. I don't know really where I'm going with that, but it's more like, I think we almost can't help but be sensitive about these topics, especially if we're creative people, especially if we're making art, because, you know, like fault lines is a perfect example. Like you're clearly thinking thoughtfully about like all of this stuff, and this choice to like include this symbolic kind of like glowing candle is like really quite beautiful, right? And it's memorializing and it's celebratory. And I feel like you have to wade into these waters because, and just trust that you will handle them sensitively, because that's why you're doing this thing in the first place. Especially someone like, as you said, you know, in your own words, like you're so accustomed to pain and living with pain that like it's hard to create artworks that are ignorant of that.
Yeah. And also about fault lines, it kind of came from fear, because I'm actually in the process of like trying to figure out how I'm going to create art when I'm completely blind, and code-based art seemed like a good way to do that. I mean, everybody goes through stuff. Everybody can relate to pain in some way. And physical, mental, whatever. I mean, we all go through different things. And so I don't know. A lot of my art comes from pain now that I think about it. And I don't know if that's a good thing.
Something that I was thinking of as I was kind of like coming up with questions about this conversation was the Toni Morrison quote of like, all art is political. And so you have that on one side, right? Which I consider somewhat inalienable. And then there's the way that I think contemporary art in general is so abstract as to be, on first glance, devoid of its politicization, right? Like if you go through like a contemporary art museum, it's just like, it's shapes, it's colors, it's like human experience, but you know, you kind of need the context of the thing to understand the politicization, the emotions, right? It's just so far removed from like what it's trying to say on an aesthetic level. And I'm thinking a lot about very like obvious and demonstrative kinds of art that focus on pain. And I think like Natrix, for example, has been very careful with the work that she does that is very like about certain topics and focusing on the pain. But there's a care because we are all in thrall to not only a literal Twitter algorithm that seems to like dampen this stuff, but also I think a culture that, like with contemporary art, celebrates things that are kind of like abstracted away from pain, right? Like you can look at all of the Art Blocks collections, the Fidenzas and the Ringers and the Winds of Yawanawa, which I know isn't an Art Blocks project, but like these generative projects that are so abstract that you don't really have to reckon with anything by looking at them. That doesn't mean they're not worthwhile in their own way, but like something like Fault Lines, you can't avoid what it's saying, right? To like, to look at it, to know its name, to see what it's actually representing, to explore it, is to be confronted with like the enormity of what it's trying to take on. And I mean, I'm curious in your opinion, like, how do artists subvert market mechanisms to reckon with their own pain and large scale pain in a way that can be like seen and not suppressed?
That is a tough question.
Oh man. Oh
yeah. I had you on before a couple minutes. I'm like, this is an easy conversation. Just a couple of friends chatting.
Oh man. I don't know. Just lean into it and hope people appreciate it. But that's a tough question, man. But like, I mean, to me, it all goes back to like everybody facing different things in their lives. And like, if they was to like take Squiggles, for example, if people were to go back in Snowfro's life, I'm pretty sure there's some bad stuff that happened, you know? And like, or even he's a programmer, you know? And so that takes a lot of time being alone and like learning how to code. And so there's no telling what all kind of stuff happened along that process, you know, to get to where he's at now. But yeah, that's, I don't even know how to answer that.
Yeah. I don't think that it's, yeah, sorry, Cole.
I just want to say that we have, we fail to give like the proper value or consideration to art that either challenges us or pushes some discussion or narrative forward, art that is painful. And I go back to kind of how you preface the conversation. Largely, we have assigned value to stuff that is colorful and stuff that is more abstract. And I think this also runs parallel to the contemporary traditional art world, is that value gets assigned in places that tend to placate as opposed to tend to challenge. And, you know, maybe theorists love or critics love to present work that challenges, but that stays in a niche. And that should awaken us perhaps a bit to the nature of what we're dealing with, which is that the process of life and the system of life that we exist in is extremely painful. And we don't want to interrogate and investigate that. Instead, we want to soothe it over. And there's nothing really new there other than a perhaps call to action to continue to challenge ourselves, or if you see something and you have a reaction, begin to interrogate why you're having that reaction and know that that viewer relationship to the object is valuable in the ways that it does move and change you.
Yeah, and I think also as far as art goes, people like stuff that makes them happy. they don't like stuff that makes them feel bad, and I'm wording that horribly, but yeah, I mean, it's the truth. People don't want to hang something up on their wall. When people come in, they're going to look at it and feel sad, like, you know. So I mean, I guess that yeah, I don't know where I'm going with that, but I feel like more people want to hide stuff like the bad stuff. And I get it, because like I said, people want to feel good all the time, and that's just not life though. So yeah, I don't know.
We could talk about this all day, and of course it changes based on what medium you're indulging in, whether it's visual art or I think film or literature, poetry, all of which I think are given different, I don't know, they're blessed with different abilities to be
vocal about the pain that they're expressing. But let's end our conversation for today, and we can all just dwell on this for a while. These unanswerable questions that I unfortunately had to hit all of us and all of our listeners with. I just want to say before I give you a moment, I really, really appreciate your candor and your story and coming on and just being like so thoughtful about all of this, Coburn, you know, likewise. But Awfully, I also want to give you a moment to kind of just tell everyone listening what you have going on, where they should direct their attention. If you have anything you want to say, announce, the floor is yours.
Well, I have a couple things, but I'm only going to talk about one. And it's the eye in the piece that was on the little poster thing. I'm going to be releasing that piece pretty soon. I don't have like a date or anything, but yeah, that was a lot of fun, and I love the way that I created that. It's been a few months in the works, so yeah, it's all hand drawn on. I can't draw on paper anymore, but I had this really dope it's like a knockoff Wacom or whatever. It's a Huion pen display. So I can draw on this thing. And I have it on like an Ergotron arm, like that swivels. And yeah. But yeah, I can paint and draw on that. So I'm really trying to focus on more of my digital painting, because I won't be able to do that forever. And it's something that I love. And it's going to hurt. Goes back to pain. But yeah, that'll be coming out within the next week, I'll say. And that's going to be on Super Rare. So
rock and roll. We'll keep an eye out. And again, Awful, thank you so much for being with us. And thank you everyone for listening. This has been the Mocha Live podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard, please give us a follow or subscribe on Spotify or Apple, anywhere you get your podcasts. Please give us a subscribe to our Substack if you want to read some writing. That's museumofcrypto.substack.com. Please make sure to check out Awful Eye. He's at awful_eye on Twitter. I'm Max. That's Coburn. And we really appreciate everyone being with us. So please have a lovely rest of your day, and we'll see everyone real soon.
Bye.
Thank you very much for listening. This podcast was edited and produced by me, Max Cohen. A big thanks to Awful Eye for being our guest today. A big thanks to Coburn Bell for being my co-host as always. Thanks go out to Julian Brangold for composing our intro and outro music, and to Day Fox for composing our cold open theme. And most of all, thank you, our listener, for being with us for what was a pretty heavy podcast. We really appreciate you being with us for this podcast, for all the podcasts before, and hopefully all the podcasts that come on after. So thank you, be well, and we'll see you real soon.